people throughout the country, throughout the state, across the political parties, are comfortable with a certain amount of support to a certain level. You can get a food stamp, but you can't get affirmative action for a job. Like, you can get just enough to say, all right, we did wrong, but I can't like make sure that you're competitive and doing well in life, because then in the zero sum mentality of much capitalistic thought, then that comes out of somewhere else. That limits my ability to succeed. And so I think government in general toes that line very carefully about investments, incentives, supports. And it's not, there's not like a financial dashboard that says, okay, well, when you do this much, it is very much an emotional thing. What makes people feel a certain way?
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Tainted Tap podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Catronelle Davis, sociologist and author of the book, Tainted Tap, Flint's Journey from Crisis to Recovery. In today's episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Brian Larkin, Flint native, city planner, and leader who played various roles within a local city government. We're talking from program coordinator for the Genesee County Land Bank to serving as Mayor Sheldon Neely's chief of staff. During our conversation, Brian spoke about the factors that make it hard to run cities like Flint, dealing with poverty, disinvestment, and long-term infrastructure neglect. He fleshed out his concerns with the settlement deal offered to residents. And he also spoke about the role of place-based solutions and efforts to achieve equitable and sustainable change in Flint. Enjoy the show. I've got Brian Larkin, Flint native and city planner in the house. Welcome, Mr. Larkin.
Hello, hello, Dr. Davis. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining me today. And please call me Catronelle. That's what's up. We were having a conversation, a very interesting conversation, about what's needed to move cities forward, given that inequalities exist and we just can't ignore them. And that's a very interesting and nuanced perspective to have as a city planner. That particular discipline has been struck with complaints about people being too top-down heavy in their interventions, not really acknowledging the impacts of systemic racism, and just being not really responsive to the needs of regular folk. And so whenever I hear folks like you present nuanced, situated perspective, I always wonder how you got there. I sometimes get this as a sociologist, not always tell folks. I came to sociology just because I bumped into W.E.B. Du Bois's work, and it just became the path. And I went down that path because it just kept calling me. But when I was growing up in Flint, I didn't know that sociology was a thing. And so could you tell me how you became interested in city planning and talk about the passion and the path that led to your efforts in the community?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking. So very similar to you, as a student growing up, elementary, middle school, high school, there was not one day where I said, you know what? I want to go to be an urban and regional planner. Not a chance. Never heard of it. It's not in my vernacular. When I was really young, I wanted to be a doctor. Then I realized I did not like the sight of blood and was squeamish. Mm. Then I decided I wanted to be a film director because I watched movies and that made sense. Then I realized I'm not extremely passionate about writing fiction or writing for writing's sake. So then I went off to college. I went to Morehouse College in Atlanta, and there I studied marketing. I was in the business program, studied business marketing. Halfway through, I picked up a minor in economics. As I'm getting towards my senior year, I recognized that, you know, I'm a part of a school that is a really big feeder system to Wall Street. the business department is like, hey, this is where the commerce of America is driven at, and we're preparing people to be a part of that. And I had no interest in it, but I wanted to get my degree. And I started to look back over my 4 years of undergraduate studies and realized whenever I was given an opportunity to write about what I wanted or to work on a project and I got to pick, it always somehow came back to Flint. Flint specifically, or areas like Flint. So the first thing I thought was, man, I think I want to get back home. So as I'm getting ready to graduate, there was an opportunity at the Genesee County Land Bank. They had a LISC AmeriCorps position. So AmeriCorps service position for 1 or 2 years to work with Genesee County Land Bank. Never had I heard of a land bank before. My minor was in economics because I was interested in economic development and how to revitalize places. So I came, I'd never heard of the organization, found out it was pretty new, relatively new, and it was dealing with vacant land. And I just
got a lot of it in Flint.
Yes, but I just fell in love. What I fell in love with was the transformative power of the built environment. And that's a lot of words, and it sounds kind of pretentious. But what I genuinely mean is,
you're talking to a scholar, so come on now.
But I typically don't like, you know, I like to plain speak. But I mean, that is exactly what it was, and it was. You think about the campaigns that we have, or the billboards, or the messages, or the radio slogans about, you know, this place is great, or this is a place of choice, or, you know, to build these communities. But when all of that is gone, when you can't hear anything, when no one's talking to you, when someone's driving down the streets of your community who's not from there, they will understand the value you place. They will understand what you think of these places. They will understand whether or not this feels safe, if this is a place of value. But even more importantly, the people who reside there. When that child steps out of their house and looks across the street, if they see a well-maintained place and friendly spaces, they feel happy about their place. They feel happy about themselves. When they see a place with broken windows and trash and people come out and throw things out of their window into the streets about them, that impacts what they feel about themselves. The built environment is telling you what people think of you. And so that was huge for me. When I recognized that, working with that, I knew this was the field that I wanted to be in. I was working under two urban planners. My supervisor and his boss were both planners. So I decided to go back to school for urban and regional planning. And that just set the whole trajectory. Planning is specific because of the built environment, but largely my goal is revitalization of communities that specifically urban communities that have been impacted. But as I'm growing in my career, I'm recognizing it's not just urban communities. I mean, it's the communities that have been left behind and those that are not a part of the plan. I mean, I think in our American system, we recognize that kind of capitalism is a system that perpetuates itself. And we adopt the values of that system as well, almost to say, you know, this is good and that is bad. It succeeded because it was good and it was bad. And I really want to challenge that to say, you know, there's times when the markets don't support places or they leave places behind.
That's right.
And it is not because those places are inherently bad. And we need to develop systems that protect and support these areas and provide them opportunities for their intrinsic value to be reflected.
I love what you just said, because you're speaking about the lack of a system, a safety net for the cities and the rural areas that are in the situations that Flint is in. These places need the support because they still have people who rely on those services, right? And I'm wondering what was happening in the atmosphere right before things really turned up and evidence of contamination emerged. I really want to paint a picture of how things were before things sort of turned up in the area.
So that is a very important question, and I'm happy to speak to it. I'm by no means an expert, and so I'll give my perspective as both and also a practitioner. But one of the key things that comes out in any discussion about the Flint water crisis is the state of Michigan's emergency manager laws. And it comes up because the decisions that led to the switching of the water sources happened under the leadership of emergency management. Emergency management occurs when the state, when a city goes into receivership of a state. This happens mm-hmm. because of financial reasons. If you're running a deficit and your expenses are outweighing your revenues, that can lead to you potentially going through receivership. If you have unmanageable debt, that could lead to you going into receivership. And this question about there's been a big pushback, you know, since the water crisis and about emergency management laws and mm-hmm. how well they work and how well they don't work. But the key, I think the most glaring example of the inadequacy of the emergency manager laws, and I mean that precisely when it's inadequate, because the city of Flint in a 10-year span entered emergency management, came out of emergency management, and entered again. And so this is prior to the water crisis. The emergency management, the receiver, yeah. the term of receivership that we were under was the second time that we had had emergency management, the second distinct span. So that in and of itself,
that tells us something.
Is enough to say that whatever the underlying financial issues that are challenging cities, this tool that we, the state, are providing them is not addressing that, because we're back in the same Amen. Place. So that is the environment with which the water crisis is born out of. It is born out of a municipal financial crisis. A city that has experienced a decrease in population and decrease in employer base, but at the same time has not experienced a decrease in its responsibility to serve its residents.
Yep.
And I think that there is a very easy or even lazy approach to say, like, oh, well, you know, you've got less people, and so, you know, you get less money. It's like these cities are distinct entities, and regardless of who's employed there and how much people make who live there and how much their homes are worth, there is an expectation that you provide a service level, that you pick up all the trash, that you maintain the streets, that you provide police coverage to get to all of the geographic area, that you have fire coverage. And this does not change because General Motors is no longer employing 30,000 people. And so how we deal with that, we don't have to. Emergency management does not deal with that in that sense. The financial tools that the state have when you get into receivership does not deal with kind of what is the base level needed. It's not a revenue conversation. For the most part, interventions at the city level operate under the hypothesis that a lot of these cities, and I use air quotes, a lot of these cities mm-hmm. are mismanaging their expenses. That yes. there is corruption going on, that there is theft, that there is loss. And if we get in there and we tighten the belt, if we reduce their expenses, then they will be able to operate functionally and they will move forward, making no issue of the fact that revenues at some point have dropped below a sufficient level to provide a quality of life. And we have to have a revenue conversation. And so that was the environment in which the water crisis was born out of. We needed a revenue conversation. The way for revenues to be generated were on the backs of residents, the backs of less and less residents who are making less and less money. So we're putting fees on their water. We're putting fees on their trash collection. We're increasing wherever we can, because we can't, in the state of Michigan, we can't raise our property taxes at a level beyond that of the rate of inflation. And so we taxes and different fees and creative ways, the only way to generate revenue, and you're putting more and more on the backs of people with fixed incomes, the backs of people who have less choice and mobility. And so you're straining these residents. These residents are hurting financially, and it's impacting them health-wise and socially.
Yeah.
And so they're looking for outlets. And so that is the environment prior to any decisions being made about the water crisis.
Throughout this podcast, we've talked a great deal about the state of Michigan and the role that it played in creating and maintaining the Flint water crisis. At the same time, it's not enough to say that the state of Michigan didn't do what it should have done when the state of Michigan is accountable to a federal agency who has the authority to step in, write directives, and make things happen when it needs to. The question is, why didn't the EPA choose to step up for Flint when the city needed its help? The United States Environmental Protection Agency was asked to address this exact question at one of the three congressional hearings held on the water crisis in Flint.
And so then you have a good person like Mr. Del Toro who steps up. What's the lesson that is learned?
I actually think that Mr. Del Toro is representative of the vast majority of EPA employees who are incredibly dedicated.
But you're here testifying that it's a high priority. He brings that up. He went to her house in February, correct? And it isn't until January of the following year. It took a year from the time he first showed up at Ms. Walter's home till the EPA actually issued a directive, correct?
EPA was working with MDEQ to try to get them to do the right thing. Ultimately,
they were suppressing those reports. They were telling they were preliminary. Mr. Edwards, what did you see as you looked at those documents? Were they trying to do that, or were they trying to suppress the evidence?
EPA was aiding, abetting, and emboldening MDEQ's cover up of this problem.
How do you respond to that?
I think that the specific facts of those matters ought to be looked at by the IG.
We're looking at them right here today. You're in charge of water quality. He's telling you that they aided and abetted the making sure that that information didn't get out. Why?
My understanding is that they were working with MDEQ to try to get action taken on the issues.
That's not what the evidence shows. That's not what those documents show. They kept saying that they were preliminary. You shouldn't rely on that data. Don't look at that data. Is that correct, Mr. Edwards?
That's absolutely correct.
What's your response to that?
I can't speak to the specific statements that were made in those communications. My understanding is that EPA was working closely with MDEQ to try to get them to do the right thing, that in July they agreed that corrosion control needed to be applied, that in August they sent a letter to the city saying that corrosion control should be applied,
and the city announced in September that
corrosion control would be applied.
Let's talk about the right thing to do. What's the number one thing you do if you're trying to warn the citizens, let the citizens know, what's the number one thing you should let them know?
I think that that's exactly the right question to ask.
I'm asking you that question, and I'm glad you agree it's the exact right question. You're from the EPA. You're in charge of water quality. I want to know what the answer is.
It's important for EPA to go back and understand all the
facts. No, it's not. It's important for the EPA to tell the public that they're poisoning their kids if they drink the water.
I absolutely agree.
Then why didn't they do it? They sat on that for almost a year.
Administrator McCarthy issued an elevation policy this January emphasizing...
This January. They had it for nearly a year. The EPA administrator went to Flint yesterday. The EPA first went to her home in February of last year. Why did it take a year?
I can't answer that question. All I can say is that they were working with...
Then why don't we fire the whole lot of them? What good is the EPA if they're not going to do that?
What's interesting about the water crisis, and when you think about the Flint water crisis, a lot of people immediately jump to, there was lead contamination in water. And there was decisions made by government, and there was this moment when everyone knew, and we recognized, and they reversed the switch. It was when the water source was switched. But it could very well have been missed. And when I say missed, is it's a crisis that had the residents not continuously pushed out, had the public health community not supported and advocated, and had there not been, you know, this consistent push, we could have experienced, we as in Flint City residents, could have experienced a switch in water sources. We could have experienced a heightened level of lead. The public officials responsible for treating and testing it may have discovered it, may have not. Could have went through the whole duration and then finished through. And no one would have ever noticed. It would not have made the news. It would not have been a thing that it was on everyone's mind. Yet and still, the conditions of the people consuming that, the public health conditions, the environmental justice conditions would have been very, very, very poor. And I raise that issue to highlight the fact that this is going on all throughout the country. And this is not, this is not a thing where the circumstances in Flint, Michigan were so extreme, you know, that this is the worst water, or this is the poorest management, or these are the worst pipes in all of America to work with this extreme. No, there was just so much pressure, and the fact that we had state oversight, which is a part of the historical system, the fact that there was emergency management and state leadership at the time, that all of this aligned for the ability for this to come to light. But this is going on throughout communities, whether you're talking about air quality, water quality, where we're locating our industrial activities.
All of that.
We are, these silent killers are continuously being consumed by our communities, and primarily communities of color, but those in our urban centers, you know, regardless, the environmental injustice knows, you know, has no preference. Mm-hmm. It's the people who decide to locate us, you know. So redlining is racist, but the water is whoever got redlined. And, you know, the air quality, all of those things align like that. And so we, when we think about the water crisis in Flint, I hope your listeners to this podcast, I hope the individuals who read your research and your book really take away from the fact that this is going on everywhere, and we have to improve our relationships with our environmental agencies, but our government in general, our government and our public, really to enhance trust, to enhance the communications into the decision-making process, and to listen. I mean, I think resident voices at the beginning of this process were largely ignored, and it wasn't until they had the advocates of the higher education community that they were then listened to and viewed as credible, and then able to be involved in the process of helping to improve
things. Mr. Larkin, we might have to talk about that. Why we got to be co-signed?
Well, and so I will be honest here. So throughout our throughout this water crisis timeline, myself, I worked in various roles related to this. So in 2012, I began, 2012, yes, I began working with the state of Michigan. And so I'm on the side of listening to the conversations. I'm working with, I'm having regular calls with the emergency managers that are overseeing Flint. If your listeners are not aware, but the city of Flint went through several emergency managers during a stretch where there was one law was repealed by voters, another emergency manager law was put into place through executive order, and who qualified to be an emergency manager switched. And so in the city of Flint, in an 18-month stretch, we had three different emergency managers. Mm-hmm. Working with them regularly, there's conversations about, hey, we want to switch our water source. At this same time, in the city of Flint, the big issue is the price. And, you know, Flint and Detroit are paying exorbitant rates for their water. And there's historical reasons why. There's poor decisions made and for generations in the buck, you know, it lands on your children and your grandchildren. And we're the recipients of poor public policy, poor management, deferred maintenance, all of that.
Yeah.
So the reason I bring this in is circling back to your point about why co-signers and what happens. Working with the emergency managers, and they're working with city council, working with others. And when I say working, you know, I'm listening and hearing the plans, and they're saying, okay, one of the cost savings, because the city of Flint is broke. You know, the city of Flint is broke. They don't have much money. There's not too many places to cut back in operations. Mm-hmm. How about we save? And one of our biggest expenses is water. Let's find a way to save. And so the second that communication goes out publicly that, hey, there may be an opportunity to save down the line by switching our water source, that next council meeting. So the announcement is made. It's publicly aware. This is 2012, 2013.
Yeah.
That next council meeting, there are people coming to meet with the council and mayor and emergency manager, different ones, complaining about their water, complaining about the color of their water, about the smell. About the, mind you, this is almost a year before the switch occurs. So what does that tell you? One, it tells you that immediately the bureaucrats are, these people are blank. And, you know, and it's, and I want to be fair to the listeners, you know, the complaints are coming from a myriad of races of people. But what is primary, what is consistent about them, they're of a similar social class.
Absolutely.
There are people who are hurting. As I mentioned at the beginning, this water is really expensive. When you're paying these bills that are higher, you're not paying for other things. So you're having to take away from healthcare and preventative maintenance and things of that nature. And so the challenge is the residents of Flint were hurting from poverty.
That's right.
You know, poverty was stricken among us. And they recognized that so many things aren't working well, and the government was not seen as a source to support them. So as soon as there was an avenue to address some of their concerns, they used that avenue.
Yeah.
The bureaucrats, the government, saw that and said, well, there's no direct correlation because nothing has changed, so you must not be a credible source. And so that's why we end up needing these cosigns, because what we're doing is we're expressing, hey, these conditions aren't ripe. I've been trying to tell you this. Maybe this is an opportunity to listen. You're talking about switching the water source. Hey, look. My water is brown and this, and I'm not able to do these sorts of things and all of these things in my life. Maybe you'll hear me now. And the leadership is saying, well, we haven't even done anything. You must be discredited or you must be crazy. And so that's the voice that carries throughout. So as you make additional decisions, I have already discredited you as a person. I've already discredited this grouping of individuals. And I move down the line with my cost-saving measures without any quality feedback. You know, without any back and forth to really listen and see what's happening, working with all those people. And so in this specific case, it was tainted from the beginning. The dialogue was tainted from the beginning. And so there was very little listening and back and forth until it exploded and you had those advocates from the public health community.
So there was very little listening and back and forth. It was more about let's discredit what you guys have to say. And that's very consistent with what we see in the literature. What we know from that literature is that poor people, working class people, oftentimes have to prove that the pollution in their communities, and it could be thick smoke, you know, rancid odor, is problematic when the evidence exists. Case in point, the state of Michigan receives the blood lead results for all children. Why they got people having to prove that there's a problem when they have evidence of it? That's not about discrediting directly. That's about abuse. So that's one of the things that I demonstrate in this book, that they've known over time that there are whole census blocks where they weren't just lead exposed, they were poisoned. Okay. And then we know that those kids who were more likely exposed with lead, poisoned with lead, those kids, and we're talking about poor Black kids, they go to the doctor, they're supposed to get a follow-up test when they're lead exposed, and they're not getting it. But the white child is getting it. So there are various disparities that are part of the system, that's structured into the system. And then there is, let's just face it, audacious neglect.
To piggyback on that audacious neglect statement, and this again, I really want to highlight the fact that this water crisis is a tipping point, but it's not the incident in and of itself. And hopefully we can open the door to the conversation about how we make our decisions, how we fund our communities, support them, because when you look at organizations, you know, large organizations of any scale, when you start having to scale back your operations and scale back your employment, the biggest hit is not usually at the top, the C-suites or the executives or the department heads. You got to run a department. You keep those. It's usually not at the service delivery. You need someone to pick your trash up and to answer your phone and to be there at the door. Where you end up cutting back is in your middle management, your program managers, your individuals who are looking over the tasks, who are keeping track of the projects or making sure that moves forward. And that's what happens in our cities when the strain comes in for whatever reasons. And I think it's of my opinion that if you look at how much state support was taken away from cities like Flint, if you look at what type of deficits they were running, there's a close correlation. You know, I think it is a logical conclusion. I don't know. I can't guarantee this is the result, but it's a logical conclusion to say, hey, there's a direct relationship with the money that was taken away from
absolutely
revenue sharing and the type of deficits that they're running. And so the state balanced its books on the back of its cities. And in order for the cities to balance its books, because you can't run a deficit, it's against the law, you have to cut. Where do you cut? You cut in your middle management. So who's watching the projects? Who's making sure that in your public works department, in your transportation, in your streets, who's making sure that the cost of your vendors, as you start outsourcing things and you need more and more vendors to help, who's keeping track of, are they staying within these costs? Oh, well, now the costs are high, so now we got to cut and switch bait real quick. Mm-hmm. Well, who's paying attention to the consistency? Are they using the same controls that the new vendor is doing? It's going all the way up to the top, to your department heads, and they're being super project managers of 20 and 30 things, and all of this stuff is just getting like, look, this is overwhelming. I can't keep up with it, and it's neglect, and it's year after year of things not being followed, or oh, hey, that's how we did it before. Or, oh, don't worry about it. We'll get to it. Or, yeah, I know we're supposed to do this report or check in with this, but the state recognizes it's just too much for us. Mm-hmm. We have too much going on. And that's, again, you know, it's compounded from the fact that they balance their books on us. We balance our books on our management. They balance, and then the end result goes down to these residents. And that is why you end up with testing or not putting the right amount of chemicals in a water source or it not aligning, is all of that. It's not just at the moment, that individual decision. It's that years of breaking down departments, reducing 100-person departments into 15 people. And, you know, you can't provide those services at an adequate level at these levels. One of the big pieces that I was trying to really see about is, and even outside of the Flint specific example, but you know, who can kind of do an assessment? You know, you have organizational assessments all the time, mm-hmm. of what it takes for private industry to operate. Who can give us that for our cities? Like, what's the base level of what you need to operate and provide quality services for the cities? And how can we guarantee that we're not going to drop below that? Regardless of how much you pay for your property taxes or the value of your homes and that, you still deserve this base quality of service. And right now we align what you get from services based on how much your home is valued, which is related to your income and the wealth of the people there. And we know that's directly related to the housing standards in the past that were racist in this practice. And so when you get to those things, I think the challenge for a lot of people now when you're having conversations about equity is you have individual actors right now who may or may not have racial or social or motivations under them, but they're built on a system that's built with racist practice. And so it doesn't matter how, like, if you are operating your best bet on a racist system, you are impacting that. In my role as a public official, if I don't bring an eye to that, then I'm perpetuating racist systems. Even as a Black man in America existing, if you aren't going to address the systems that have created these inequities that you're operating on, if you're just going to assume, hey, well, you know, it must be right. Right is right. Dollars are dollars. Less is less. More and more is more. You're going to perpetuate these racist systems, whether you yourself identify as a racist person or as an anti-racist person.
His comments about the lingering impacts of racist and classist systems on ongoing tensions are spot on. It's true. We need to take a good look at the policies and practices that perpetuate the unequal distribution of resources and supports and change them. Case in point, a few months before evidence of water contamination emerged in Flint, residents had been attempting to get the city to reconsider its policies that unfairly excluded renters from the city's poverty exemption that helped them pay for the water bills. At that time, although Flint was one of the poorest cities in the country, residents were paying 3 to 4 times more for public water than neighboring communities and could have used the help. Check out this public comment from a March 2015 City Council meeting.
Good evening. Thank you. My name is Chris Del Marone. I live in Flint, Michigan. This evening, I'd like to address you as the chairperson of the City of Flint's Border Review. As you may well be aware, the Border Review is where property owners have the opportunity to appeal their assessed value and taxable value. This is going on this week. In addition to the assessed and taxable value, they can appeal their classification. There is a program available for veterans and also a poverty exemption. The concern that I wish to address this evening, and this appeal process is going on this week, tomorrow from 3 to 9, Wednesday and Thursday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. What I wish to address today is on the poverty exemption and how it applies to the water bill. Residents can get relief on their water bill if they qualify under the poverty exemption rule or guidelines. There's two components. One is on the income. If they qualify there, then they have to qualify based on the amount of taxes they pay. So it is possible for someone to qualify based on their income, but not qualify based on the property taxes they pay, because the property taxes have fallen to such a level that the city believes there's no relief needed. The problem with that is that for renters, there's no relief at all. This program is only available for those who own their home. It's their primary principal residence, and they live there. So if you're a renter and you have a high water bill, there's no means to access this program. My suggestion is that council or the powers that be look at that and see if there's a way to include renters. Obviously, with the high rental percentage here in the city of Flint, that might be a financial burden, because if they are granted relief, they're granted relief on the city water service and the city sewer service. And those are probably the largest portion of most people's bills. The water usage is relatively low compared to those charges. What I might propose or to start looking at is if somebody qualifies based on the income, if they're a renter and they qualify based on the income, that then they be given some relief on the water bill, irregardless of whether they own the home. This way it would give renters an opportunity to get some relief from the city in regards to that water and sewer service fee.
When the water crisis starts, all of those tensions have a focus point now. All of them have everything for the next year and a half was because of the water. Whether it was or wasn't, it was, these are my ailments. These are my concerns. This is my stress. This is my, all of that had an outlet. The challenge of the Flint water crisis experience was that residents, especially those who felt ignored for far so long, finally had the opportunity for their voice to be heard.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Talk more about that.
I am going to talk more, but hopefully you don't take your amen back when I finish this.
Let me say what I mean by that. I have heard from folks that people who spent years living their life began associating all of the bad things going on in their world with the water crisis. And there is an element among the folks in the group who are just looking for a payout. If we're going there, or if you're going in that direction, I've heard it and I'm not mad with it, because I think there's an element of truth.
Yes,
to
I'm
that.
Going there and taking it a step further. And which that point is exactly right. They were given a platform, given a voice. But the sinister aspect of it is that the only way to improve your condition and to make it beyond this is to give up your voice. So there was this fear amongst individuals of saying things are better, of moving beyond this crisis, because the crisis is the only thing that is attracting the adequate resources that we should have been getting for years, attracting the attention, getting the support, getting the government to pay attention and hold people accountable and enforce the law. But as soon as I let go, so there is a reticence for many to say, hey, the water in Flint is good or bad. The condition is improving. Things are progressing. Things are better. Because when you say that, then we don't matter anymore and you go back to ignoring it and we're vulnerable towards the next thing. And I say we as the collective, not me as we as an individual. Mm. And that is the painful part.
I love that.
That we have made it to this platform from exploiting our anguish and tragedy. And there are no other avenues left out that are readily apparent of how to get the adequate support, of how to hold accountability without making yourself pitiful. And that really, it's so challenging for me. I would like to move beyond. I would like to be a community of, I want to move beyond the word resiliency, because resiliency, it's an amazing thing, but resiliency is a reactionary thing. No one talks about how resilient New York is or how resilient Los Angeles or Chicago are as cities. Resiliency is associated with the wrongs, with being knocked down, with bouncing back. I want to make it to a point where we are a community that is
thriving.
Yes. Yes. Thriving in and of itself on its own merits.
Yes.
Moving forward. And we don't have that platform. We don't have that avenue right now because of this platform that exists that people are afraid to let go of, that we've received positive things from, but there's no pathway forward through this.
I do think that you're right when you talk about the fact that we have to do more than be resilient. We have to do more than push through. Mm-hmm. We actually have to come up with better systems. We have to come up with better expectations. And we have to come up with, I think, you know, a better way of dealing with each other. I mention that because a lot of my time was spent over the last 5-6 years watching city council meetings. And I was thinking like, wow, so they're in the middle of a crisis and we're talking about rules and procedures and beefs from last year and things of this nature. It's just incredibly weird. And I wonder if folks are clear about how this is not helping. And so I really wanted to circle around the fact that I think you're right when you say that we have to be willing to do something different. Do you think the settlement is moving Flint in that direction?
Not particularly. To answer your question directly, do I think the settlement is getting it us closer to moving forward? No. Do I think the settlement is appropriate and an appropriate response to the circumstances? Yes. I think it's an appropriate response. I don't know much about dollar amounts and how that breaks down for individuals.
Oh, don't worry.
I think there is an importance. There is a monetary response. However, what do we lead with? We said this is a systemic issue.
Mm-hmm.
And until there are solutions that perpetuate themselves, every amount of however much money you do in a one-time payment can be spent. And when that money is spent, unless something was changed, you will be back to where you were before the start of the money was spent.
Pretty much.
And the challenge is until we are putting systems that are replicating themselves, that are either providing continuous benefit or providing revenue or economic, you know, and some of this is outside the means of what the settlement as a mechanism can do. So I don't want to
exactly.
Say that.
Exactly.
I don't want to say that the state in a settlement fashion should put a different dollar amount. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the issues are not going to be solved with this. This is an appropriate response. But to address the long-term issues of poverty, the long-term issues of inequity, long-term issues of public health challenges, you're going to have to change your policies around what you can do under your ground and your infrastructure, what you can do, what you can put into your water. This starts at the EPA level and the state level. You're also going to have to change how you're investing in your residents. So
yes.
The difference between charity and investments. Investments means your success is tied to the success of the individuals that are supporting you. None of the interventions that have come to Flint right now, Okay, this may be a bold statement. So broadly speaking, none possible.
I'm good with bold. I'm good with bold.
but I want to be fair. I want to be fair. None of them that popped to my mind immediately are in any way is the success of the resident tied to the individual that's providing the supports. So that being said, most of what the response has been thus far has been, how do I deal with my liability from whoever? How do I make this end? Whether it's the PR.
Go away, yes, yes.
How do I make this end? As opposed to an investment is, okay, how do I put these resources in there? Because then when they're successful, that's going to make me more successful. Investors want to see the things that they invest with flourish. And so it doesn't have to be a tangible, okay, here's $100 million to build a certain thing. But at the same time, if you took hundreds of millions of dollars and we invested in state-of-the-art technology related to water quality and infrastructure treatment that was started in Flint, that hired Flint residents, and then that was replicated all throughout the country, that would have much more lasting impact than any of the interventions thus far.
That's right.
Holding all things constant, if you improve the economic well-being of an individual, their quality of life improves, their health outcomes improves, their mental health status improves, because then they have the agency and action. And so if that would be the thing, so let's see this opportunity to take these hundreds of millions of dollars to go into investment that's centered on the people who are inflicted by this, and then we take that and find a way to replicate that across the country to prevent these sorts of things elsewhere. Those types of conversations are not the ones that are happening. And they're a little bit beyond the scope of, state government or federal government. You know, I'll be honest, I don't know how realistic it is for me to sit up and expect them to, roll up with this solution. But those are the solutions that will say, hey, you remember there was a before and now an after, and this is how we're moving forward. It would be with investment.
I think you're absolutely right. Final question. I really want you to get at why this approach or that mindset seems to be beyond the current scope and what we need to do to change that perspective.
So I think, and I haven't given this a lot of thought on the limitations and why it isn't occurring and the challenges. I think there's a lot of resistance to this sort of thing. I think people throughout the country, throughout the state, across the political parties, are comfortable with a certain amount of support to a certain level. You can get a food stamp, but you can't get affirmative action for a job. Like you can get just enough to say, all right, we did wrong. But I can't like make sure that you're competitive and doing well in life, because then in the zero sum mentality of much capitalistic thought, then that comes out of somewhere else that limits my ability to succeed. And so I think government in general toes that line very carefully about investments, incentives, supports. And it's not, I don't think it's, there's not like a financial dashboard that says, okay, well, when you do this much, it is very much an emotional thing. What makes people feel a certain way? So as you mentioned, there's the settlement. There's a congressional appropriation that happened. There are state dollars. So we're talking, if you look at leverage impact and outside things and grants that the city was now more competitive for because of the water crisis, it is no exaggeration to say there will be $1 billion coming into the city of Flint since the start of water crisis towards the end in direct response to this. Would some of that have already come? Possibly. But let's say there will be $1 billion. People are comfortable if you let it trickle in and you do it in one-offs and you align it with a specific thing that they can say, okay, pipes, got it. If you did $1 billion worth of investment into the economy and let the function and let the government operate and do what it's supposed to do to fix its own pipes and let the public health systems do all that. And now there's these jobs and incentives that are targeted specifically for investments. That's going to pay off for generations and generations, and people are not going to feel as comfortable who did not get this benefit. And I think that is where the limitation of government is because you're a government of the people, and you can only do as much as that appetite allows in many cases. I mean, there are some bold leaders who say, look, I have this platform and I'm going to express my views, and I think this is what is right, and you know, move forward. But look at how long this process has gone. We've gone over multiple governors, we've been over multiple presidents, we've been through changes, and the systems usually balance themselves out. So if you have a dynamic leader, eventually it'll be followed by a more, you know, I don't even want to use conservative as a political term, but just someone who's less, you know, risk averse, mm-hmm. and who brings those things back. And if you have someone who's looking more equitably to distribute wealth, you have someone who's going to balance that out. And so governments in and of themselves have to do a quick hit, get it in there, get the systems in, and get out of the way. And I think that leaves them to do a lot of these short-term things when, in fact, the long-term investments in the economy occur. And they have occurred over time, but they usually occur in ways that the majority of the population can swallow or tolerate.
I think you just said a word there. What I especially like from that statement is when you spoke about the fact that systems will only deliver what their appetite allows. That was a word. And I think it's incumbent upon people to figure out how to encourage the appetite. Mm. Oh, I just absolutely loved our conversation today. I want to thank you for your time. I really enjoy learning about your walk, your journey. And I didn't get to hear much about your work with land banks, and that's my fault. But I look forward to learning more about that work because of your standpoint. All that said, thanks again for joining me today. You've been an excellent guest.
Well, Katrinelle, thank you for inviting me. And when you write your next book and do a whole podcast, you can invite me back and I'll tell you all about land banks and the exciting work going on all across this country.
Fantastic.
To learn more about the crisis, be sure to pick up your copy of Tainted Tap, Flint's Journey from Crisis to Recovery, on Amazon or your favorite digital bookshelf.
Thanks for tuning in to the Tainted Tap podcast. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Till next time, pivot forward.